If you want to greet the rising sun with a rousing song, I think you know what you need, a great cup of coffee. But all the creatures great and small, especially any of you familiar with this podcast, know that the secret to a great cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But there's no way to know when the coffee you buy was roasted. That is, until there was Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf, and they deliver this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Maybe you're the forgetful type who's not good at ordering things on time. Hakuna Matata! Sparkplug offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that all the remembering is done for you and you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
It's the Sparkplug Coffee of Life. Top 100 Project.
And action.
Hey, filmic types, and thanks for hearing the Next 100 Project, the weekly podcast that spends some time chatting about reputable movies. Sometimes not so reputable. In this case, pretty reputable. And if you're new to us, hear now that this podcast will spoil all sorts of secrets in this flick. I'm your dog person host, Ryan Ellis, and here's my even bigger dog person co-host and wife, Bev.
That's me.
To hell with cats! Stupid, stupid cats.
Even the royal kind.
Especially the royal kind. We'll get to that very soon. So, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Lion King. What is your favorite Hamlet adaptation? Laurence Olivier's in 1948, Franco Zeffirelli's with Mel Gibson in 1990, Kenneth Branagh's in 1996, the Ethan Hawke one in 2000, Hamlet 2 with Steve Coogan, or is it this movie, The Lion King?
I'm going to go rogue and give a patriotic answer. Strange Brew.
Really? Yeah. Isn't that based on Macbeth?
Well, it's a guy who kills his brother to take over the brewery, and his niece has to defeat him.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I remember hearing it was a Shakespeare adaptation, but I thought maybe it's Macbeth. Okay.
Well, I mean, you could argue that Lion King is also a Macbeth adaptation. I think Macbeth and Hamlet have lots of similarities. It's just whether you're focusing on the hero or the villain, really.
Well, I've only ever watched The Lion King more than once of the movies I mentioned, so I guess I'll have to go with that one.
That's your favorite? I do have to give a shout out to Hamlet 2, which oh my god, I love that movie so much. I'm such a huge
fan. Was the one I expected you to say. That's why I threw it in
know,
there.
I know, but I'm sorry. I had to do it. I had to throw it out for my Canadiana.
All right, Strange Brew for you and Lion King for me. I've never seen Kenneth Branagh's version, though. I meant to. It's so goddamn long.
It's 4 hours. I just can't bring myself to do it.
And by the way, Lion King based on Hamlet, but also it's based on an ancient Egyptian myth, which was Osirian, I guess, and a real West African story. So it's not just the Shakespeare play.
Also, it's kind of based on Bambi, striking resemblance to the story of Bambi.
Including torturing poor kids and making them cry to their parents and having cute hijinks save the day. So, the Next 100 Project's 73rd motion picture, The Lion King, was indeed nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Disney, of course, premiered the film in May 1994, then they cut it loose in June. To ask if this was a hit or not is to insult the very concept of hit movies. It was a monster. So, Bev, for those who somehow don't know what this movie's about and they must not like movies but somehow are listening to us anyway, read them the skinny.
Welcome to the savannah, where birds are birds, zebras are zebras, and Mufasa the lion is the benevolent king of Pride Rock, a noble place where the subjects are loyal, despite occasionally being eaten by their monarch. The birth of Mufasa's son and heir, Simba, triggers Mufasa's jealous brother, Scar, to kill him and try but fail to kill the young Simba, who's forced to grow up in exile. When Scar proves to be an incompetent and destructive king, Simba must return to claim his rightful place as the king of Pride Rock.
I think that's how it's said. Or in a nutshell, entitled little prick runs away from responsibility, then assumes unearned place of honor only after intense goading from characters far more worthy of leadership than he is.
Or how about, here's another one, hoes before bros. I think he's probably more motivated by the idea that he's gonna get laid.
We are gonna pork tonight.
Shout out to the, what is it called? The Honest Trailers.
I contemplated this podcast being G-rated, but no, it's gonna have to be R-rated because we've got some things coming up later. Some controversial topics. So let's just fucking swear and be controversial. Why not? That's what we do usually anyway. We rarely have G-rated episodes anymore. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 92% of critics like the movie, 110 fresh and 10 rotten, 93% of audiences, and it is currently 48th on the IMDb's top 250. That's pretty impressive. It was 49th when I looked only a few days ago, so somehow it's raising up their ranks there. And it was second at the 1994 U.S. box office. Forrest Gump was number one, but Lion King worldwide was number one in 94. And it's a monster hit on video in such a way that I think I read somewhere it's the number one selling video of all time, including video, DVD, and Blu-ray. It's 19th on the Box Office Mojo's list of the top 200 adjusted for inflation. The only two animated films that are higher on that list are Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and 101 Dalmatians, which have had a lot more time and re-releases to get to those rankings. So The Lion King is pretty impressive anyway, but especially when you consider those movies have had many more chances to gross more money.
And it also grossed billions in toy sales.
More so than probably, well, maybe not more than Snow White, but yeah, probably more than 101 Dalmatians. And Lion King is one of my most anticipated movies ever. I saw the rough trailer at the Disney store and was blown away by it. As I recall, it was in pencil, whatever they call that, you know, the rough sketch. It wasn't even the full trailer. What I saw blew me away, and I knew I had to see that movie. And funny enough, Forrest Gump's the other one that year. When I just saw the poster, I thought, I gotta see that movie. I don't know why, because Tom Hanks was becoming the star, I guess. But those were the two huge movies, and they were the ones I really wanted to see. The Circle of Life opening scene was the entirety of that original trailer. And it's also one of the few movies I've ever seen in the theater twice. That must say something for it, because I just don't go back usually, because what's the point? You can see it on home video as much as you want to. All right, well, enough intro and prologue. What do you think, Bev, about The Lion King?
Well, as we've addressed before on the podcast, I have a cold, dead heart and an immunity to nostalgia, so I'm typically not moved by anything meant for kids. But I totally see why Lion King is the touchstone that it is. It's a great script. It has great songs. There's great voice performances. And I think the main event is just breathtaking animation, starting with the sequence that you talked about that wound up in the trailer. I don't think it really gets better than that in the whole film, but rarely has anything gotten better than that opening sequence,
the Circle of Life. The Wildebeest Stampede later on was epic, and it involved computer rendering, which was still pretty new at that point, so maybe that comes close to beating the Circle of Life in the opening.
Yeah, it has the drama to go with it. It took 5 animators 2 years of working exclusively on that scene, including, like, some pretty rudimentary computer animation, 3D animation.
And it's the saddest part of the whole movie. The dark stuff that's in this film, especially for a cartoon, Scar murders his own brother. It's not accidental. It's a rare thing in a Disney movie where somebody is deliberately murdering somebody else. Even you mentioned Bambi. It's a hunter shooting at a deer. That happens. The whole thing about, oh my God, the, whatever, 39th greatest villain of all time in movies is man in Bambi. And I was so pissed when I saw that on that Heroes and Villains list. I thought, it wasn't deliberate. They didn't try to make Bambi an orphan.
It's all about perspective, though.
But Scar is trying to kill Mufasa, and he's trying to kill off Simba so he can take over. But then again, this has been brought up by a lot of people online, is Scar actually a misunderstood non-villain?
Well, he's definitely the best character in the film. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Irons breathes incredible life into him. His dialogue is the best in the film. He has this amazing, rich, erudite language, and he chews the scenery. Oh, his performance is just this beautiful ennui, you know, especially at the beginning when he's just so put out by everything, his nephew and his brother and Pride Rock and all of it. I love his performance. I think he's the best character.
I agree with all that, but do you think he is a pure villain? Or is he actually trying to do somewhat the right thing, in fact, bringing in the hyenas? Because Mufasa is a hyena oppressor.
Yes, I agree. I say he's a villain mostly because once he gets power, he's a terrible king. He's just kind of selfish and he doesn't listen to anybody. He seems to just want power for the sake of power.
Someone else in charge of something important is doing the same things right now in the country below ours.
Yeah, and for the simple reason of ego and petty jealousy of Mufasa, who, for what we see of him, he's almost too perfect. He's, like, boringly perfect as a king.
Oh, yeah.
He's thoughtful, and he does his job, and he tries to manage all the different animals when he's not surely eating them. There's a deleted scene right there.
Well, they do have that scene where it's the whole, yes, Simba, let me explain. You see, we will murder antelope and whatever else as much as we have to eat, but when we die, we will slowly decompose, and they will very slowly get their revenge by eating us as the grass.
I guess if you're going to make a movie where the protagonist is a predator, like the lions, then you're gonna have to explain to kids why they have to kill other animals that you're meant to like. He should be eating Zazu. He should be eating Timon and Pumbaa.
Well, you mean in that case, you got Mufasa should be eating Zazu and Simba should be eating Timon and Pumbaa.
Yeah, they should be. Absolutely. In the regular natural order of things.
So do lions have to be taught to be killers? Why doesn't Simba try to eat Timon and Pumbaa even as the little lion cub? Maybe he learns not to, and they're his friends and everything. Okay, fine, I can grant you that as he gets older. But why doesn't he try to when he's young and obviously starving to death out in the desert when they find him? Just because they're nice and funny?
He's also weak. Mm-hmm. He's in a weakened state. They save his life.
It's also the Hitchcock answer, because if they are eaten by him, then there's no movie. And they are the saving graces in what could be an incredibly dark story. It's dark anyway, but it's not that much fun unless Timon and Pumbaa are on screen. And I've forgotten how funny Nathan Lane is in this movie. I've seen it 5, maybe 6 times, and I still laughed out loud at some of his lines. He is hilarious.
And there's some great animation, too.
That's what makes it funny a lot of the time, too. The look on his face. What's going on here? It's helped by the look on his face and the way they draw him.
And it could so easily be like a dumb, easy laugh, his dancing distraction near the end in the grass skirt and everything.
Dance a hula.
Little Polynesian, you know, reference thrown into a movie.
Where did they get that from?
I know. Where'd they get the Brooklyn accents from? I mean, the movie's full of things that don't fit in there and cultural references that don't fit in.
Just like Aladdin a few years before that. Now, let's go back to the beginning. The opening sequence is one of the most famous in movie history, I guess, where you got to go meet your new king. And of course, that's a reprise at the end with the other new king, Simba, and his cub. But you said it a minute ago, go meet the guy or the guys and the women who might eat you one day. It's also a bit of a Noah's Ark story almost, because there are more than just two of every animal, but they're all flocking to one place. I wonder if that's supposed to be a subtextual thing that's Noah's Ark as well. The Pride Rock is the big boat.
Yeah, there's definitely a deceptive amount of peace in this kingdom when you consider they could all be prey of the king at any moment. And the Circle of Life is bullshit, hypocritical rationalization for lions being the unquestioned rulers of Pride Rock and just eating their subjects with impunity. When the time comes for them to pay the piper, fertilize the grass, they sure treat it like a real tragedy. The first two songs are about the virtue of death in a way. Circle of Life is directly about how death is part of life and how we remain part of life even after we pass. I Just Can't Wait to Be King. Well, has anyone told Simba how he becomes king?
My father dies.
I just can't wait till dad dies. Again, credit to Honest Trailers. I didn't come up with that. So doesn't it follow then Mufasa's death, while surprising, is all part of the natural order and directly beneficial to Pride Rock, but more specifically Simba? Hyenas are scavengers. So according to the Circle of Life, sorry kids, they ate Mufasa.
And they also are doing a noble deed by helping the decomposition and helping him turn into grass.
Yeah.
I also read online that it's a little bit backwards, that hyenas, actual hyenas, are not really the scavengers they're portrayed to be, that they're not so much the bad guys in reality, that lions are the ones that just as much as anything will go after something that's laying on the ground, and hyenas can be the ones that have done the killing.
I don't see why being a scavenger makes you a bad guy anyway. You're kind of the cleanup crew. It's actually like a very necessary part of the ecosystem. Yeah. And for the record, hyena biologists sued Disney for defamation of character for the unflattering portrayal of hyenas, and they argued that the depiction could actively harm efforts to preserve hyenas in the wild.
Just like there should have been a shark lawyer after Jaws, because great whites do not act like the shark in Jaws.
So the original intention for casting of the hyenas, they cast Whoopi Goldberg and Cheech Marin, and who plays Ed?
Jim Cummings.
Jim Cummings plays the wacky Ed.
Yeah.
Originally, they wanted to reunite Cheech and Chong. They wanted Tommy Chong to play the Whoopi Goldberg part, but he refused to get on board. And I'm sure he's crying all the way to the bank for the last 23 years about that.
You got that backwards. He's not crying his way to the bank.
Yeah, I'm crying. He's not laughing his way to the bank. He's crying, but all the money...
There are no funds in there I could have had. Not as much as I could have had anyway.
Yeah, instead they cast Whoopi Goldberg. They changed the part to woman, which actually is more accurate for hyenas. Hyenas are a matriarchal society.
Interesting, too, that they cast her in this role because she won the Oscar only a couple years before, just like Jeremy Irons did in 1990. He won for Best Actor in Reversal of Fortune, where he has the same line he has in this movie. You have no idea.
But they put that line in because...
Because he was in Reversal of Fortune. Yeah. And Whoopi Goldberg won for Ghost in that same year.
Whoopi Goldberg, one of many African Americans cast in... Well, I guess African period, just black people cast in this movie, far more than the regular average of any Hollywood film.
Which wouldn't really matter when they're just voiceover roles, but you're right.
I think it matters. I think you can tell. I think you can hear it.
Well, James Earl Jones is Mufasa, and her, and who's the other one again? I'm forgetting. Oh, the Robert Guillaume as Rafiki, who was on Benson. Of course, him, yeah.
Okay, and the young Nala, also. Although it's funny, they cast a black girl to play young Nala, and then they cast a white woman to play
Moira
Nala.
Kelly.
But you hear the difference in her accent. She has a clearly urban accent when she's young. There's many things that you could suggest are maybe not outwardly racist, but perhaps a little insensitive and irresponsible of Disney, and one of those things could be, oh, when Nala grew up and was mature and a grown-up, she ditched that urban side of herself and
Scar
became a white woman.
And Scar helped her do it, maybe.
And Scar, while he has a British accent, is the dark one.
Yeah, right.
It's not intentional, but it's not responsible.
Well, Disney's been accused of that in a lot of other movies, too. But you're right, the voiceover actors are often black, and the characters' names are based on Swahili words, including Simba, which I read means lion, or young lion, I guess.
Like a lion cub.
But the other major roles, like Matthew Broderick as the older Simba, and the kid version is Jonathan Taylor Thomas from Home Improvement, who's cute but annoying in this at the same point, which isn't his fault. He does a good job with the voiceover.
The character's written.
The character's
annoying.
One important point, though, early on is when he and Nala are trapped by the hyenas and they're almost killed. He makes that happen by being so inquisitive and going somewhere his father specifically says not to go. But he also saves Zazu at one point when he could get away, and he saves Nala at another point when he could get away. So he has the heroic instinct early on as a kid. So he fucks up by having them go there in the first place. His idea, but he also does the right thing after he had initially done the wrong thing.
And as mad as his dad is at him for going there and not respecting Zazu, no wonder the kid doesn't respect Zazu. Mufasa treats Zazu terribly.
Bad boss.
Zazu, who, yeah, he may be this priggish British bird, but he performs an important job for the monarchy. And his dad's like, watch this. I'm a responsible grown-up, and I'm totally going to let my kid pounce on this poor, unsuspecting bird who knows it's going to happen eventually and is just forced to take it. Simba, as a lion cub, is 3 times his size. So no wonder he doesn't respect Zazu. No wonder he doesn't listen to anything Zazu says.
He is a bully of a boss. Well, speaking of Mufasa as a father figure and teaching maybe some disputable lessons for Simba early on, and by the way, they do telegraph that Mufasa's going to die with all of his talk of mortality.
Oh, yeah. Who tells their newborn cub, I'm going to die someday?
More than once. Yeah. In his about half hour of screen time, that's about all that he's on screen at any point. We see him very briefly later on as a vision. But anyway, I ask, who are the better father figures? Mufasa, with all of his responsibility talk and all that kind of stuff, but also teaching Simba the wrong thing to do by bullying an employee, or some of the other things he teaches him. Or the permanent vacation team of Timon and Pumbaa with the Hakuna Matata mentality.
Well, I'm sure the movie wants us to say Mufasa because ultimately Simba has to come back to Pride Rock and take the monarchy back because that's the right thing to do. Pride Rock is suffering without him. But, you know, from a personal point of view, I would totally choose Timon and Pumbaa and their lifestyle, even if it means eating grubs.
And why is Simba entitled to this? Because of royalty. And I hate royalty. I've always fucking hated royalty.
Oh, let's talk about
this. This is a classic example of where it's just a crock. He doesn't even want it in the first place. And like I said, two characters bully him into it, both Nala and Rafiki, until he finally realizes, well, I guess three actually, because of the vision of his father. And finally he goes back there, I gotta go save the day for everybody. But he doesn't even care about the other lions. He also feels a little bit too guilty, maybe, about the Mufasa death. It's a bit far-fetched that he would feel like he cannot go back. Oh, I caused the death. Just because his uncle had told him, whatever it's supposed to be, months or years before. It's all your fault, Simba. As he gets a little older, you think that he would start to realize, wait a minute, yes, he died because of me, but it isn't my fault he died.
It's not his fault at all. He didn't predict that there was going to be a stampede. He went exactly where his uncle told him to go and hung out there. So it was purely circumstantial. But it's the Hitchcock answer. You just had to have that for conflict. That's the central conflict. That's what kept him away all those years. So you say he didn't care, but I really think he did care. I don't think he ever stopped caring about his mother or Nala. Oh, also, just a quick, reasonably good question. Are they the only three males in the whole pride? Scar, Mufasa, and Simba?
I was reading, and I may be wrong about this, lion people will correct me, I'm sure, or animal people, or just more learned people, but I don't think it's normal to even have had Mufasa and Scar be part of the pride. It would be a male, and then all the females.
What happens to all the other males?
They either run off or they're killed. If they want to take over from Mufasa, like Scar does, then they fight. And if Scar wins, then he's the man in charge. And if he doesn't, then bye, you're either dead or you run away.
Disney, who loves nothing more than good conservative values, like valuing a monarchy and valuing heterosexual pairing off of couples, choose lions as their subject when lions are harem-keeping.
Well, not everyone's going to know that, though, so you've got a little spin job here, and you've got three males involved. Now, maybe Simba, when he grows up, had his uncle not tried to get rid of Mufasa and then successfully did it. Simba at some point would challenge his father, and if he wins, then he's in charge. I guess that's how it works. I really don't know, but I think that's the basic idea.
It's funny that Scar never seems to take a wife when he's in charge. Although there has been accusations that he is the evil queer, that this is another example of Hollywood having an evil queer. Not that it's ever overt. There's nothing overtly heterosexual about him. He has no sights set on any of the lionesses in any way, and he kind of has this effeminate, effete way of talking, his intellectualism, that British accent, and physical weakness, the fact that he can't take on Mufasa.
I'm at the shallow end of the gene pool in that area.
And the way you say that is a good impression, and it is a feminine way of speaking. And there's certainly a couple of shots in his song. What's his song
Be
called?
Be prepared.
Right. Yeah, there's a couple of moments in
the
that.
The Hitler march thing where, going on there?
Yeah, he has like a bit of a limp wrist in some of that stuff, just some ways of looking at the camera that, yeah, are a little bit effeminate. I don't think it's totally wrong. Well, any Disney film, any kids film, any film that needs to tell a story succinctly in 90 minutes is going to rely on shortcuts because they don't have time to really delve into the depths of the characters and why and how they are the way they are. So they use shorthand like, well, he's the bad guy. How do I know he's the bad guy? Well, he has the yellowest eyes. He has the darkest mane. He is effeminate.
His claws are always bared.
And he has this extreme British erudite accent. Now, Disney is both the chicken and the egg in this, where it's like, on one hand, they didn't create necessarily these stereotypes that are often at least mildly harmful and sometimes extremely harmful, but they certainly perpetrate these stereotypes and are responsible for that. Making a villain effeminate or making a villain darker than the rest of the pride is not a responsible thing to do, but, you know, it's 1994, or actually 88 when they started making it.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to go for the shorthand, so you have the noble-looking lion who looks just like a lion should look in your picture books, and that's Mufasa. Mm-hmm. And then you have Scar, who's kind of like the counter version of that. Quickly, immediately, the audience goes, well, he's the bad guy, obviously.
And also I talked about the fact that a lion could challenge another lion to be the king of the pride. So, in effect, that's what Scar does. He just does it with craftiness by using the wildebeests and height to kill Mufasa.
He uses intelligence.
Right, but he doesn't actually fight him mano a mano, but he does beat him. So if you go by the logic of a lion challenges a lion and wins, that's what Scar does.
Although, if he's intelligent, why is he so bad at running Pride Rock?
Well, because it's implied that the hyenas destroy things. He's also the weather dominator.
Right.
A G.I. Joe reference, by the way, for those who watched that cartoon in the 80s. But when he goes in there, suddenly all the weather gets bad and it's a drought. It's just bad coincidence. Maybe it's like winter's coming in Game of Thrones. No one controlled that. Winter's just coming because winter's coming.
It looks like Earth after the robot apocalypse in The Matrix, where the sky is so dark and the land is so bleak, it's just littered with bones. How quickly did this happen? Like, how much time has passed? Enough time for Simba to grow up, but you have all these bleached bones taking over the savannah. Like, the whole landscape is just corpses. How did this happen so fast? And why is it as soon as Simba takes over, the clouds break, the sun comes out? Even God wants monarchy to be a valid system of government.
The unsubtle answer is that, exactly. But then at the very end, we see his cub's been born and everything looks plush again. But that's also been months because the cub has to be conceived and then been born and all that other stuff.
And you could argue that it was a bad weather day, and that's just pathetic fallacy, that the savannah there had been stripped dry because they had been irresponsible with the land, and he had let the hyenas take over, and so that kind of disrupted the ecosystem. I guess you could argue that.
Well, at the very end, Simba won't commit avunculicide. Did I say that right? I think so. He won't kill his uncle. But it's shocking that Scar doesn't die in the fall he takes, because that was a Disney trope, and I guess still is a Disney trope. Rather than the hero having to kill a villain, the villain will be in a position and the hero might say, I'll help you. No, I can't. Or the guy falls, or he refuses to take his hand, or whatever it is. And it is a nice reversal, in fact, that the hero of the movie, Mufasa, dies in a fall. But more often than not, Beauty and the Beast is a good example of this. Only a few years before, probably the most famous Disney movie before this, and arguably including this, the villain dies in the fall, so Beast doesn't have to be the bad guy.
Yeah, well, that's the ticket right there. The Beast can't be the bad guy. Simba can't be the bad guy. He cannot be a murderer.
But the hyenas can be.
But the hyenas can be,
and yeah. They got smack
And that's pops. Also, like, just dessert. He deserves that.
He talked bad about
that. Yeah. Like the hot mic thing. You get caught saying something stupid. Like that.
Good. But all this dark stuff is offset by the Timon and Pumbaa characters, who in a way are not necessary, but they're also the saving grace, because this movie might have been a very dark, bleak affair if it weren't for them. So funny. Nathan Lane is best known for his Broadway performances. I guess The Birdcage a few years after this is another big role he was in. And then The Producers on Broadway and in that really bad movie with Matthew Broderick, of course. They did that together. That was a gigantic hit, one of the biggest hits in Broadway history.
Yeah, before Hamilton. Actually, yeah. Before The Lion King, what am I talking about?
Yeah. And even Book of Mormon. Well, hey, we're still talking about all these things being huge hits. Let's not dispute that The Producers was still a big hit, maybe not the biggest of all time. Ernie Sabella is Pumbaa, and he's played Pumbaa so many times in so many direct-to-video movies and then just offshoots and that kind of stuff. He's made a career on playing Pumbaa. He's been in other things, but that's by far his most well-known role, and he keeps on going back to it over and over again. So I guess you agree with me that those characters are funny, right?
No dispute there? Yeah, and you say, oh, I guess they're not that necessary, but I think all the best movies have good comic relief. You have to have a balance between the serious and the lighthearted. And I think Hakuna Matata is the best song in the movie. Circle of Life and Can You Feel the Love Tonight, really bland ballads. Yeah. I don't like either of them. I know they were huge hits, especially Can You Feel the Love Tonight. It was a massive radio hit. The soundtrack went diamond, which is 10 times platinum. It sold a tremendous number of copies.
Another thing it shares with Forrest Gump.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, that's right. But it's the only animated film to ever do that well. Pumpkin. Maybe until Frozen. I'm not sure if the record was broken by Frozen. But I'm not really in love with any of the other songs in the movie, but Hakuna Matata I just find unbearably charming.
Tells a good story, too. You see Simba growing up.
And the part with Pumbaa and, like, the reason that he was ostracized from his group.
When I was a young warthog.
I love that part.
Well, Can You Feel the Love Tonight, which was the Oscar-winning song, and as we probably know, Elton John was involved in that. He sang it. I think he was a co-writer. That's born out of Timon's jealousy that they're losing a buddy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they start and finish the song. They're the little bookends.
Which is also done in Beauty and the Beast. That was the Oscar-winning song in 1991, and that was sung by a character in the movie mostly, too. And at the end, you've got Celine Dion singing the version that people probably know better. And, of course, Celine Dion's a better singer than Angela Lansbury.
She's a better singer than everybody, well, if I can be patriotic for the second time.
And that is a lovely song. Beauty and the Beast is a really great song, no doubt. But I just find that interesting that the song that was so well known from these two movies and won the Oscar from each movie is sung by characters within it who are not nearly as good as Celine Dion and Elton John. And they even rhyme.
And they were both huge radio hits. You heard them everywhere all the time. And it's not often, especially an animated film, accomplishes that.
We've talked about the cast a lot, but I guess the top-billed actors, Matthew Broderick, of course, Ferris Bueller's his most famous role. We covered him in Election not that long ago, and I mentioned The Producers on Broadway. He's fine as the adult Simba. James Earl Jones, though, is definitely more commanding. He's more commanding than almost anybody ever. The voice of Darth Vader is the thing he's best known for, but don't forget of his small role in Doctor Strangelove, and he often has son complications for his characters, Darth Vader and now this one.
And another movie he was in called Coming to America.
Yes.
And I bring that up because he plays a king, and you know who from plays
Africa.
His wife?
Same actress.
Same actress who plays his wife, Sarabi, in The Lion King.
Madge Sinclair, that's right. Yeah. Probably deliberate casting, and she's also black, so another black actor with a fairly major role, a supporting player. But he's great as Mufasa. It could have been Liam Neeson, Sean Connery, or Timothy Dalton. Probably many others, but they're the ones people talk about online. Interesting choice with Neeson, because he wasn't really that much on the scene. He did Schindler's List the year before, and I forget if he'd done that many big movies. Obviously, Connery's the big name there, and that would have been an obvious thing. James Earl Jones is well known with his voice, but Connery probably even more so.
I have a lot to say about the accents in this movie, but putting like an Irish or Scottish accent in Mufasa would be weird choice.
And Connery never changes his accent, so he would have been Scottish.
Neither does Liam Neeson, really.
And Liam Neeson did later play a lion as a voiceover role in the Narnia movies, so he eventually did that, just didn't do it when he could have in 1994. And then Jeremy Irons, if you've never seen Dead Ringers, that's the movie of everything he's ever done you gotta see, where he plays twins. Incredibly well done, technically, that they're both on the screen at the same time. Of course, that's split diopters and that kind of stuff they did back then, and all kinds of mirroring of film, because it's before digital became
more
a big deal.
More Canadiana. I don't know if that's technically a Canadian film, but it's a David Cronenberg film.
Yeah, and shot here, for sure. One of the great performances of all time. He plays two distinct characters, maybe the best twin performance of all time, along with, I would say, Nicolas Cage's adaptation, which might get reviewed before this year is over. And maybe even more so, you know, which character is which, even though he plays them basically the same. They look the same. But anyway, that was Irons' best performance, but he won the Oscar in Reversal of Fortune a few years after. And, of course, the villain in Die Hard 3 the year after Lion King. And he's also got the same eye wound that Al Pacino does in Scarface, but there's a little less coke and swearing in The Lion King.
That we know of. Not on screen, at least. Well, I mean, maybe there's a reason Scar is just so much skinnier and weaker than
Mufasa.
I wonder
who gave him that wound in the eye.
They never explain it, right? How did he get that?
Just Scarface for
maybe
a good reason.
Maybe he did fight Mufasa once and he lost.
But somehow he's still alive because Mufasa is benevolent and maybe a little dumb to let him stay in there. Well, we mentioned Zazu, that's Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean, who doesn't speak, and yet here's a character he plays where he speaks as much as anybody in the whole film.
Well, Rowan Atkinson has played many characters that do speak. It's not like Mr. Bean is the only thing
he's But it's the thing he's best known for, he doesn't talk, that's what I'm saying. And he's pretty funny, too. He's not as funny as Timon and Pumbaa, but he's pretty good. And then Guillaume as Rafiki is unrecognizable. I don't think I knew who he was when I saw this movie the first time, but it's one of those characters you forget about until later on you realize, oh, right, that's the guy from Benson and whatnot, who doesn't sound anything like this African, what is he, monkey, what hell he's supposed to be?
He's macaque monkey, or he's a specific kind of monkey, I can't remember. Speaking of accents, I know I keep bringing it up, but I find the accents in this movie really interesting because they made a choice to give all these characters different accents, even though they're from not just the same part of the world, the same hometown, even the same family, and they have these distinctly different accents. I was talking about using shorthand to explain something about characters really quickly. Well, Rafiki is a great example too. You give him an African accent, he's the only character with an African accent in an African movie, and that imbibes him with all the wisdom of the ancients. You know, he's the connection to his land that gives him a wisdom and insight unique to him.
And he's the medicine man that anoints both Simba in the beginning and then Simba's son, I guess, at the very end. With the whole holding him up in the air and scaring the shit out of that poor lion cub hanging over this, whatever, multiple hundred foot drop.
What is going on? This is what's going on in that kid's head.
And speaking of great accents or just doing voice work, Frank Welker, he's a legend, or at least he should be if you're a movie fan. He does all the lion roars. I guess they didn't record any from actual lions, which is just fascinating. I didn't know that.
He has credits in tons of movies.
Over 800. 800 credits and 151 in movies alone. He's been doing things for a long time. I think even on The Simpsons, he's the guy that will do a dog growl or a cat meow or a lion roar or just a normal voice. He is great. He's
one of the underrated. Yeah, there's going to be like a scramble in Hollywood the day that he dies or retires and they have to find somebody who can do all the... They'll never find anybody who can do all the things that he does. They'll find probably dozens of people that will have to replace every little thing that he does.
And by the way, that whole cast we just talked about, okay, Aladdin would have been a better example with Robin Williams playing the genie the year before this, but Disney movies didn't cast big stars in their voice roles, certainly not in the early generation when Walt was at his prime in the 30s and 40s. No big-name actors played those roles. But then the Renaissance came with The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and this. And that, by the way, is an influence from the early movies where it was Snow White and Pinocchio and Bambi and Dumbo. Well, here was this Renaissance. Those movies are pretty close to being as good as those old movies were.
Yeah.
But it was Aladdin that started it, and this one took it off even more. And then Toy Story, which is a Disney property, I guess you could say, that started casting big stars. And then some animated movies have made the mistake of just focusing on have the big names. Shark Tale, I'm looking at you. At the expense of a story or even great animation. And then you're doing the whole thing of, oh, that actor, I know that voice. Oh, that's that guy. Okay, that's that guy. And that's that woman. And you're spending 25 minutes in the movie trying to figure out who the voices are rather than just focusing on a Jim Cummings or a Frank Welker, who are the voices in this movie. Well, Frank Welker's the line roars. But anyway, hearing them and not focusing on the fact that it's names you know, actors you know, but there are a lot of big names in this, as there were in Aladdin. Not so much, though, in Beauty and the Beast, and certainly not in Little Mermaid.
And I think animation is the worst place in the world that you can do stunt casting, which has happened way too often. Or even just casting of somebody who's a star just because they're a star. I don't think just any actor, even good actors, can do animation. You have to have an animated voice. You have to express yourself twice as much. It's a different kind of performance. Comedians do it great. Theater performers do it great. But then perhaps Brad Pitt doesn't.
And he has done it,
like,
though.
Tarzan, well, that's the thing I'm thinking of, where you get, like, a bland performance, you get a bland movie, it just doesn't work.
He wasn't the voice in Tarzan.
What is it? It's not Tarzan.
Tony Goldwyn was Tarzan. You're thinking of Sinbad.
Sinbad, that's it.
But Robin Williams, who was in Aladdin before this, is a textbook example of casting a big star and him enhancing the movie and making it even better. And they base a lot of their animations on what he was doing. Bev's giving me a face that says no, but hey.
Unpopular opinion.
The fans like that movie.
I disagree. I
like that movie because of what he brought to it.
I know. A, I found it way too much. And B, why would you spoil a classic Disney film with pop culture references that now, a few decades later, are irrelevant to most audiences, especially kids?
There is a theory going around, and there's so many theories about the great movies or the classic movies, the most popular movies. And with Aladdin, it's that the genie is a time traveler and he's gone into the future. So why is he referencing Jack Nicholson, Rodney Dangerfield, and Robert De Niro and all these people that wouldn't have been around hundreds of years before? It's because he's seen into the future and he's gone all the way around. So that's why he knows about Jack Nicholson.
Okay, he's a time traveler who's just particularly fond of the 80s and 90s.
And also still stuck in a lamp. All right, so the people behind the scenes, well, I guess everybody's behind the scenes in an animated movie, aren't they? But the directors were Roger Allers and Rob Minkoff. Allers was an Aladdin writer, and Minkoff went on to direct Stuart Little 1 and 2, which are very delightful animated films. Not animated, actually, but they've got Stuart Little as animated, and then Gina Davis and Hugh Laurie and the others are not animated. But I really enjoy those movies. Haven't seen them in a long time, but kudos to him for some pretty good pseudo-animation follow-ups to this one. The writers, there are nearly 30 people credited as either writers or story or with additional material credit. But the main writers are Irene Mecki, Jonathan Roberts, and Linda Wolverton. And it sounds like Tim Rice, who was, I believe, a writer on Can You Feel the Love Tonight, so he won an Oscar for that, should have been given a screenwriting credit, but the WGA, for some reason, stopped that, despite the fact there's so many other people they're credited with writing the movie in some kind of way behind the scenes.
Yeah, they spent years finessing this script.
And the only producer was Don Hahn, who worked on Beauty and the Beast a couple years before, and then later Maleficent. So he's got some pretty impressive credits on his resume. This movie was Jeffrey Katzenberg's swan song before joining Spielberg and David Geffen at DreamWorks SKG, which I believe started after this movie had just blown up. The movie's 178:1, so basically it fills your widescreen TV. It's a DVD that we watched, and it was a rental because the one we owned wasn't working. I don't know why, but we had to go out and rent it. We were supposed to watch and review this movie when we did In Cold Blood, but we've had to reverse them because we had to buy some time. So it was going to be a fun movie with Lion King, mostly fun, actually. A lot of death and destruction, actually. And then the movie about killers, and then a fun movie next week, but instead we had the movie about killers. Then the Lion Killers, I guess, basically, and then the fun one. The editor was Ivan Bilancio. This was his first of four movies. He works mostly in animation and was on Wreck-It Ralph, which is a modern, not classic, but a movie I liked a lot. And you talk about great voices for animation, there's a good example. Sarah Silverman is fucking awesome in Wreck-It Ralph, and so is John C. Reilly, but Silverman is outstanding. It's one of my favorite modern, maybe ever actually, voiceover works in an animated film. She's so cute and funny and great in that movie. And then the music, Hans Zimmer. He was getting to be a big name. He certainly is now. He's worked a lot with Ridley Scott and Christopher Nolan more recently. Of course, he did Rain Man, which we might cover in about 6 or 8 months. But this guy never stops working. You want to see a guy's resume, a composer who just is always writing music. It is Hans Zimmer. And of course, he's known for his wah, which is used in trailers so often now. The music won the Oscar. I don't know if it really should have. What do you think of the score? And you already talked about what you don't like about the songs.
This kind of score I hate. It's just broadcast. This is how you should be feeling right now.
I would have given it to Forrest Gump or even Shawshank Redemption because their scores, I can hear them in my head right now. I can't really hear the score so much.
No, it's nothing like remarkable about it. It doesn't have a tune that stays in your head or like a theme that you'll always remember. You do remember the songs, but no, the score is just kind of, it's nothing all that unique or original.
It's what you've often complained about. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
His only Oscar so far, and he may win another one day. The guy never stops trying to make music. As I said, he's done some classic ones. Pirates of the Caribbean is another one, and all those Nolan movies in the recent era. Okay, this movie is very influential. First of all, the multitude of straight-to-video flicks and spin-offs, and Ernie Sabella's cashed in so much as he's played Pumbaa. in the opening sequence, of course, the oft-imitated Yanni Wanya. Whenever there's a sunrise in a movie that has nothing to do with Lion King, CinemaSins does this, and it makes me laugh every single time, because they'll play that over the sunrise, because that's what it's known for from Lion King. All right, well, here's where we definitely get R-rated, although we've said fuck a few times anyway. But the porn parodies. This is not something I've ever brought up before in a podcast, but I got thinking about this, and I looked it up, and there is one. The Loin King. Can you feel the penis tonight?
Oh, come on. You can do better than
me. I thought of some other ones. How about Hakuna Makaka?
Oh, dude.
The Circle Jerk of Life. And I just can't wait to be kinky.
Hats off. Hats off to you, sir.
Yeah, The Loin King is not mine, but those other three are. The movie quotes some past classics in the same scene, in fact. Are you talking to me? Taxi Driver, and then They Call Me Mr. Pig from In the Heat of the Night. So in the same scene, you got Pumbaa doing the old quoting. I didn't get that when I saw the movie in 1984. I hadn't seen Taxi Driver or In the Heat of the Night at that point. So a lot of the kids had no chance of getting those references. They had not seen Taxi Driver either, I'm sure. And then, of course, the merchandising, which was a Disney thing by this point. They made so much money off of selling stuff.
Did you mention the musical?
Well, we talked about it a little bit, musical? Yeah.
Okay.
It's a big hit, yeah.
It is currently the highest grossing Broadway musical of all time and the third longest running show in Broadway history. And it's such a cultural touchstone that it's part of Broadway now. You know, we've seen The Book of Mormon, and because it takes place in Africa, they have to reference The Lion King. Like, several times they talk about Lion King because it's a play that takes place in Africa, hilariously so. And I think when I was reading the playbill, a lot of those actors were from The Lion King. That was their previous credits. And I guess if you're black and you are a Broadway performer, Lion King is where it's at. That's where you get the good roles. And now, of course, Book of Mormon and Hamilton, obviously things are getting better, but I think in the 90s, when Lion King went on Broadway, it was probably one of the first great opportunities for black performers.
Oh, good for them. Another good influence then.
Mm-hmm.
Way to go. And they're very funny in the Book of Mormon. I can't speak for Lion King. Never saw it. But Book of Mormon, they steal the movie maybe from the white Mormon actors who are very funny too.
I don't think those actors are Mormon. As a matter of fact, well, I mean, that the person who played the lead
is gay, but yeah. I mean, they're playing the Mormons.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
All right, the awards and list section. The movie won 2 Oscars for Can You Feel the Love Tonight? The song and the music score by Zimmer. And it was nominated for Best Song for Circle of Life and Hakuna Matata. So 3 to 5 nominees came from one movie. And as we're saying, Hakuna Matata probably should have won. It was 99th on the top 100 songs list. The other two were not on that list at all. Over the Rainbow from Wizard of Oz was number one. And Hakuna Matata probably should have been higher than 99th. But at least it was on there. The other ones weren't. Lion King made the National Film Registry, so Congress is preserving it. In 2016, just last year, along with The Birds, The Breakfast Club, Thelma and Louise, which we covered last year, and a movie we're going to talk about in seconds, or at least a few minutes, The Princess Bride. Interesting class of movies. Also, Rushmore was in that group, and I'm not a huge fan of that one, but that was a pretty good year of inductees. Lion King was 4th in the animation category of the top 100 genres. Of course, Snow White was number 1. And Lion King was also nominated for the top 100 Cheers, top 25 musicals. That would have been a reasonable choice if they'd put it on there. And the top 100 songs with the other two that didn't make that list, Circle of Life and Can You Feel the Love Tonight? All right, last thoughts on The Lion King.
I can see why it's a classic. I can see why it's a huge touchstone for millennials. We're just a little bit too old to really get nostalgic.
I loved it when I saw it.
You loved it, but you were an adult. I mean, it would be a different 20. Kind of love if you saw it for the first time when you were 8, grew up watching it over and over again.
Traumatized by Mufasa's death.
But I'm glad when kids like a movie like this because it's really beautifully crafted, and I think its greatest legacy is one of the last great classically animated films. I don't know if they'll ever make films like this again because digital has taken over, and rightfully so. It's better in a great many ways, but this is as good as it gets for classical animation.
In the modern era, yeah, okay. It's a schizo movie. I gotta say, I like it a lot. It's one of my favorites of that year, and it's one of the better animated movies of all time, but it's very schizo. The musical numbers are fun, but the story is deadly serious.
There's a surprising amount of dissent on The Lion King. I assumed it was a universally loved film, but when you go and you dig and you look at what critics were saying about it, more critics than you think were not that impressed. In the context of the Disney Renaissance, where they were comparing it to Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid and Aladdin, they were like, I mean, I guess it's fine. The Rotten Tomatoes numbers are surprisingly low. There's like some people who do not like this movie and argue that it's not one of the real Disney classics. They're disappointed that it's considered one of the greatest Disney
films. Rotten Tomatoes, 92% and 93% from critics and audiences is pretty damn good, and the IMDb highly ranks it. So I know I had you're assumed saying.
It was more of a universally beloved film.
Most films are not, though.
No, most films are not. I just thought that this film was. I did not realize that there was anything but universal acclaim for Lion King. It's a bigger money hit than it was a critical hit, but of course, 92% or 93%. Still an incredible rating, don't get me wrong.
It's also one of the rare movies at that point, at least, that was non-human. There's not one single person in this entire movie.
Yeah.
It's all animals.
And they're not quite as anthropomorphized as most animals are in animated films. They're obviously anthropomorphized in the way that they have a human-like society, and they speak English, and do many person-like
things. Rather than Swahili.
But the animators went to Africa to watch animals move and behave, and to mimic their emotions, rather than have them stand up on two legs and walk and talk like people the way Yogi Bear does or something like that.
Timon wouldn't be as funny if he didn't, although he is a meerkat and they do stand up at least on their back legs. Mm-hmm. They walk around that way. Timon, the savior of the film. And Pumbaa. I'll always love this movie and always be a fan, but it's flawed, so I will call it a flawed masterpiece.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
All right, well, when we kick back into gear in 7 days with our final August movie, we'll tackle a beloved favorite that Congress also decided to preserve last year in 2016, The Princess Bride. The coming attraction trivia for The Princess Bride. Since The Princess Bride is so hard to pigeonhole, that's partly why it wasn't a big hit. What would be your nutshell, you or anyone listening to this right now, Bev, summarize this movie in one pithy sentence, if you can. And I'm sure anyone probably can.
All right. So for that pithy sentence, please check out next week's podcast about The Princess Bride. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to The Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And rate us, review us, helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, SparkBlockCoffee.com.
In short, this podcast is doomed. And over.
And cut.